I had a few apologies, but it looks like there's a few more, so we'll start. So maybe we'll just start with, this is part two of the Kabbalah Personal Growth. So maybe we'll just start with a little review of last week. So we talked about last week how this is the period of personal growth in the Jewish calendar. Personal growth is something obviously which is a lifelong mission, symbolized by the period of the Omer that we're in now, which is the journey from Egypt. And we're taught every generation, every day, one has to go out their own personal Egypt. It's all about growing and taking the next step. We discussed the two souls, the animal soul and the godly soul, known as the Nefesh Elokit, Nefesh Habamit. Both are godly design, both are Tzelem Elokim, in the image of God. We discuss what that means. So that means, Kabbalistically, we talk about the four worlds, the four highest world being the God's world, which is Atzilut. It's God who in his infinity is not defined by anything, but he chooses to manifest himself in 10 Sfirot, 10 definitions, infinite definitions, but definitions nonetheless. And then everything in existence, all the other worlds are all governed by those 10 powers. But in each world, the creations of that world are normally connected to one or the other of the Sfirot, of these 10 emanations, right? The exception is the human being, which possesses all 10, both the godly soul and the animal soul. And therefore, because it's all by, and that's a very important component, because that means that the person possesses that power of infinity, that we can embrace things that are not part of our own personality, right? That was the whole idea, which we'll develop a bit more tonight. We discussed the concept that every midah, every emotion that we have is godly designed, therefore it's intrinsically good, just needs channeling. We nurture the areas of emphasis, but make sure it's channeled in the right way. And then part of that growth is also, like we said, embracing that which isn't us, which we're not comfortable with, because that's part of growth, realizing that we have the ability to engage and embrace something which is not really our conscious personality, our obvious personality. Okay. So let's develop this tonight a little bit in more detail. So what I want to do first is just have a look again at the chart. But this time, more look at it, not in terms sort of godly powers, more our own personality. The 10 powers of our soul, right? You have it there on the handout. So, as I said last week, it divides into different parts. So the first part is our intellect, which I'm not going to go into in great detail. It's Chochma, Bina, and Daat. When you conceive an idea, you understand an idea, and you internalize an idea, connect to the idea, and so on. But I want to look more at the world of emotional response. So the reason why I'm doing that is because when we talk about our personality, who we are, right? You don't know a person from their intellect. Intellect is a tool, right? Intellect is how that person has the ability to process information coming from the outside, right? And internalizing it. So you don't know the person. You know what they're able to understand. You know what they're able to transport from the outside, but you don't know who they are. The personality of the person, who is the person, or how is the person recognized and noticed or understood from their emotions, from their feelings, from their responses, from their emotional responses, right? It's interesting because although we say that one of the most important ways that a person needs to function is what we call moach shalit al alev, which is the brain must rule the heart. In other words, our emotional responses are supposed to be guided and revealed and exposed through our thinking, right? So the more we think about something, the more we're able to build an emotional attachment to it. So what intellect does, and just let me explain this for a minute, intellect either guides an emotion or even creates an emotion, right? There's some headlights here. So let me just explain that. So for example, right, we say that in Kabbalah, the powers of intellect are called parents. So Chochma and Bina are known as Av and Aim, the father and the mother, all right? Why? Because we are told that thinking, intellect, gives birth to emotion. For example, if you think about something and you understand its greatness, the more you understand the greatness of something, the more you might come to be emotionally attached to it, right? And in fact, in a healthy human being, that's the way it's supposed to work. We're supposed to think, we're supposed to have a set of values, we're supposed to be able to process information, we're supposed to have our, as important as passion is and as emotion is, our head is supposed to rule the heart. So an example of that is, in the spiritual sphere of things, the famous concept brought down in Hasidic philosophy about there's a mitzvah in the Torah to love God. Right? In fact, we say it every day in the Shema. We say, V'ahavtat Hashem alakecha, you should love Hashem your God, right? Love God, fear God, and so on. So my Maimonides already asked this question. How can you command someone to love something? In other words, you can command someone to do something, right? So I can do something even though I don't like to do it. I can eat something I don't like the taste of, right? But you can't command me to love the taste of something. You can't command me to love another person. I either like them or I don't like them, right? Very simple. So the Rambam already explains, and this is developed a lot in Hasidic philosophy, that the command is not to love. The command is, because that's you either do or you don't. The command is to engage in a thinking process, to engage in a thought process, an intellectual process that will lead you to love, right? So that concept is very much emphasized in Kabbalistic and Hasidic literature, that there's a mitzvah to learn and to understand God to the best of our ability. Because the more we understand Him, the more we have a chance of coming to love Him, right? That's the concept. So having said all that, right, and that's why the emotions in Kabbalah, so the intellect, the chokhmah, the two primary intellectual powers, chokhmah and binah, right, the two primary emotional power, intellectual powers are called av and ein, they're called father and mother, and the emotions are called children, because they're born out of thinking, right? Having said that, Kabbalah is very clear. That doesn't mean that... Sorry? Right? It doesn't mean that emotions can only come out of intellect. Emotions exist on their own. In other words, in the depth of the soul, in the subconscious of the soul, emotions have their own source, their own origin. In fact, Kabbalah says they have a deeper origin than intellect does. But the way in a healthy human being how emotions work is that they are guided and sometimes revealed, nurtured, enhanced, channeled through the brain, right? I'm just saying that because when we talk about a personality, which is really where personal growth lives, in other words, personal growth lives not in how much we think, but it's more our personality, it's more our emotional responses, how we respond to the world, how we respond to situations, how we respond to the way we live. That's much more got to do with the seven emotions than for the intellect. Now, we need to use the intellect. The intellect is a tool, but the personality is really much more in our emotions than it is in our intellect. So let's have a look at the world of emotional response, right? So let's have a look at that. So if you see there, it says the world of emotional response. So I went through this briefly last week, but let's have a look at it quick. Just now, a bit more detail. So the way our emotions are structured in triangles, so we have the right, the left, and the middle, right? So the first primary triangle of our emotions, in fact, the two primary emotions we have are chesed and gevura, okay? So chesed is everything to do, when we say emotions, by the way, we don't mean, like when we think of emotions, we think of, I mean, you can have a long list of emotions, right? Revenge, resentment, jealousy, love, fear, all these things, right? Obviously much more than seven, but when we talk about seven, they mean the seven principal categories, seven principal tools from which all the other emotional responses are derived, right? So please ask if you lose me or you want to understand something. So chesed is everything got to do with expansion and connection, right? So love, flexibility, disorganization maybe, connecting, expanding, creativity, all these things, indulgence even, all these things have to do with chesed, right? So that's a long list of things, right? So chesed people might, I don't know, might like the outside more than the inside. They might like spending time outside more than the inside because they like to be freer, right? It's more of a chesed sort of thing. Even though the word chesed means kindness, not only kindness, obviously it includes love, compassion, kindness, all these things, right? But it's all got to do with anything that's expanding outwards. Everything that is less contained, everything that is fluid, is more to do with chesed. On the other hand, you have gevura. Gevura is more everything that's got to do with restraint. Rejection or restraint, holding back, not giving, right? Which can be good and bad. In other words, that could be being inflexible, being organized, being loyal even, being aggressive could be also. Aggressive could be, it's a form of rejection, right? You don't want to give, you hold back. Self-control is a good thing. That's also part of gevura, right? So that's the chesed and the gevura. And the truth is that those are the two primary emotions of the human being, right? They govern. Whenever you want to give examples sort of the two types of emotions that people use or people live by or experience, it's chesed and gevura. Yeah? Tiferet, it's interesting, the word tiferet, which is in the middle, you see there, right? The word tiferet means, it actually means beauty. That's the word tiferet means, right? Mm-hmm. Why is it called beauty? Because Kabbalah says that beauty always comes when you've got like a garment, for example. It says a garment is there's a certain beauty in the multiplicity of colors. So you call harbe gavnim, and you've got something that's more than one color and they blend together nicely, that's a certain beauty, right? Or I suppose in the world of music, you can think of it like one instrument could be very, very beautiful, but a symphony of instruments, when they blend together, is very beautiful, right? So that's why Tiferet is sort of the synthesis of chesed and gevura, right? And very few people, by the way, are naturally Tiferet. That's part of the work that we have to do. It's like very hard to actually blend them together. Most of us, at least in certain situations, will be more gevura or more chesed. But Tiferet is that blending together. Now, that's why it's the middle, and Kabbalah is the whole thing that the Kav HaEmtzai, which means the middle line of all the Sefirot, that's the line that goes all the way up to transcendence. It goes and connects with Ein Sof, the infinity of God. Because as soon as you take two opposites and you bring them together, that's an expression of infinity. It's an expression of not being locked into one or the other. Not being locked into the right or the left. It's the ability to bring them together and to transcend higher, right? So that's the concept of Tiferet. We gave an example last week. We'll give some more examples soon about how they come together. How Chesed and Gevura sort of come together. That's the first triangle. That's the primary triangle of our emotional makeup. Then we have the second triangle called, if you see, that's called Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. So this triangle is what we call a supportive triangle. So Netzach means like ambition or determination, right? Endurance. Now that's also on the right because it's more of a chesed thing. In other words, it's about, so let's say you can have chesed, you can have a nature to love or a nature to give, for example, right? But a lot of obstacles in the way. So there's obstacles, you know, you're not in the mood, the environment is not set up for it. People are standing in the way, people, obstacles in the way. So Netzach says, no, I'm gonna overcome that obstacle. It's a supportive emotion. I'm gonna persist. But it's persist to connect, it's persist to do, it's a persist to keep going, right? So that's why it's a supportive emotion of chesed, it's on the right as well. Hod is sort of the opposite. It's again, it's about holding back. Like I should give, but I know I need to hold back. I want to be aggressive, but I'm going to hold back and I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be humble. Like it's the opposite of ambition, right? Ambition sometimes is like, for example, sometimes ambition needs the balance of humility, right? Or surrender. Because sometimes ambition can be start of good and can go all bad. But because it means it distracts other people, it stands in other people's way. People are ambitious sometimes at all costs and can be very, very destructive. Sometimes it needs to temper, it needs to be, let's hold back from that, let's not give so much, let's hold back, that kind of thing, right? So again, Netzach and Hod are sort of the supportive emotions of the world of Chesed and Gevura. In fact, Kabbalistically in our makeup of our body, Chesed and Gevura is the right arm and the left arm. Netzach is the right thigh and the left thigh. So the legs are supportive, they support the body, right? Yesod is called bonding. Now, what that means is, Yesod means bonding, it means connection. What does that mean? It means the ability to start thinking about how we're going to relate this to other people. You see, because emotions, right? I'm just explaining what they mean just briefly. Emotions are about our response to the outside. But emotions don't necessarily mean we connect to the outside. Right? So for example, let's say te chesed. Chesed means I feel very kind. But I don't have a relationship with anyone that I'm going to be kind to. I just feel kind. Right? Yesod means how I take that and I'm going to now build a relationship to someone else. So now I'm connecting to another person to be kind to.
Rabbi, isn't the meaning of yesod foundation?
Yes, in Hebrew, but in the Sfirot, it always means the concept of connecting. Right? In fact, in the makeup of the body, so you know that the one of the reasons that the body is Tzelem Elokim, not just the soul, is that the body is made up to reflect the 10 powers of the soul, right? So, Chesed and Gevurah is the right arm and the left arm, Teferet is the abdomen, Netzach and Hod are the two legs, and Yesod is the sexual organs. It's the idea of connecting, the idea of bonding, right? Brit Milah is always connected with Yesod. So, right. Malchut is the actual giving. So let's take the example of kindness. So kindness would mean I have a relationship with someone that I'm going to give to, but I haven't given yet. Malchut is putting it into practice, right? So Malchut is actually being mashpia. It's actually giving and actually bonding to the others. So that's the yisod of Malchut. Okay. Now, yeah, is that clear? So, let's just give an example. We talked last week about the godly soul and the animal soul, right? So just again, the godly soul is the soul we have within us that is primarily focused on being godly, okay? On pursuing a higher purpose, pursuing a godly purpose, right? The animal soul is primarily, at its source, primarily worried about a physical survival, but left unchanneled, left untamed, it becomes more egocentric than that. It's more just about physical eating and sleeping and surviving, but it's more about indulging and pursuit of pleasure and pursuit of selfishness and pursuit of what's good for me and self-centeredness, and eventually it lands up in evil, which is, I think someone asked this last week, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is like an outcome of the animal soul. Let's give you a couple of examples. Let's take Chesed, for example, right? So when is chesed, which is the attribute of kindness, right? Let's say kind or giving or connecting. So when is chesed an outcome of the godly soul, right? So an example of godly soul chesed is love of God or love of others in a very selfless way, selfless love of other people, right? Where it's nothing to do with me, it's nothing to do with egocentricity, it's about love of others, helping others and so on. As a tzedakah, giving charity. As I say, avat Hashem, love of God. These are all examples of chesed coming from the godly soul. Okay. What does chesed look like when it comes to the animal soul? Well, it could be either neutral, either selfish. So neutral could be just our natural desires to want to survive, to eat, to sleep, to be mundane, but mundane in a neutral way. More than that, if it gets deeper than that and the ego sort of takes over, then it becomes more selfish in pleasure or indulgence. Permissiveness, for example, is a very permissiveness in the immoral sense, right? Where you have people who are very just permissive, but everything goes. So that's an example of chesed, which is coming with emphasis from the animal soul, right? Okay, so that's sort of chesed. Let's give example of gevurah. Okay, so gevurah. What's an example of good gevurah? In other words, gevurah coming from the godly soul, right? So that's loyalty would be a good example. Loyalty in a relationship is a concept of gevurah. Interesting enough, by the way, right? That's why you need both in a relationship. See, chesed is not enough to have love, because first with unstoppable love can love anything and anyone. Loyalty is more about, no, it's channeled to one place, for example, right? So the concept of loyalty is actually a gevurah thing, which is interesting. And that's a good gevurah, right? Self-control, fear of God, all these things are just good values and good and coming from more from the godly soul, at least from the animal soul. Coming from the Nefesh HaBamik, from the animal soul, things like aggression, some things like resentment, things like revenge, these are all animal soul things. Now, in the Shema, this is a really a question. In the Shema, we learn, we there's a famous verse, I should have copied it, but let me just tell you the verse. We have quoted it before. It says, V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, you should love Hashem your God, b'chol levavcha, with all your heart. Right? Now in Hebrew, so there's a problem with that word. Right? In Hebrew, if you wanted to say your heart, how would you say it? Levavcha?
Lev shelcha.
Lev shelcha or libcha?
Libcha.
Oh, right. Libcha with one letter bet, right? Libcha, your heart. That's how we conjugate it, right? Levavcha has an extra letter in it. So it's got two times the letter bet, right? Excuse me? Levavcha. So our rabbis tell us, what does it mean? Because God tells us, I want you to love godliness with both your hearts, meaning both your souls. B'shnei yitzarecha, that's the expression, right? You need to love God with your godly soul and your animal soul. What does that mean? If the animal soul has negativity to it, why don't we just eliminate it? What's wrong in my godly soul taking over? And forget about my animal soul. Let's suppress the animal soul. Right? And just love him with our godly part. What's wrong with that? Why does God insist that we love him with all of us? Okay? And there's lots of ways to understand that, but a couple of ways as follows. First of all, so we said last week, there are some very specific animal soul traits that are not intrinsically bad. Like jealousy is normally seen as a bad thing. But is jealousy always a bad thing? Not necessarily. Right? Sorry?
I can't see jealousy having any goodness.
Ah. So the Talmud tells us, Kinat sofrim tar b'chochma. Jealousy can be channeled. It's good jealousy also. I mean, there's a couple of conditions that make jealousy good, but so it says that the jealousy among the wise increases wisdom. What does that mean? See, what defines jealousy? I'm just giving an example. There's so many examples to give, but just one example. What defines jealousy as bad?
When you wish bad upon someone because you envy whatever they may have.
Ah. So first of all, the first thing about jealousy is that normally it's not just about I want what you have. Mm. I want it and you shouldn't have it. I want to have more than you, right?
I want what you have, but I no longer want you to have what
exactly,
I want.
Exactly, because you want to have
the king.
Exactly, right? That's just, I mean, it sounds terrible when we say it, but that's the truth, right? That's human jealousy. That's number one. Second part of jealousy is normally jealousy is very physically, materially centered. So it's about not having enough, always being jealous. In other words, it's connected with greed. It's about always wanting more, right? The Talmud says, he who has 100 always wants 200. He has 200 always wants 400. Oh, it's unstoppable, unsatiable sort of need for things, right? Need for pleasure, need for materialism, and so on and so forth. So when that jealousy is channeled into something good, what it looks like is, number one, it's more about something which is more valuable than just material possessions or material things, number one. And number two, it's never about the other person who shouldn't have it. You got me?
Why?
It's about aspiration. So nothing wrong, right? And looking at someone and saying, you know, that person is able to do a mitzvah in such a beautiful way. I want to be like that person. I don't want he shouldn't be like that.
Okay.
I just want to also be, it's an aspiration.
Positive jealousy.
Right. That's positive jealousy, right? So, sorry?
I didn't see that jealousy is the right word for that.
Okay, so, right, because it becomes more ambition or aspiration, correct. But it's still a concept of looking at someone and saying, I wish I could do that, right? Which is how jealousy normally starts.
Follow somebody's lead that you
okay. Okay, exactly, right? It's like there's a saying in many places where it says that, you know, you should always look at, when it comes to, you know, there's a passage in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Father, that says, who is a wealthy person? He who is happy with his lot, right? So many places explain that's only true in the physical, but it shouldn't be true in the spiritual. It says that when you look at, when it comes to the physical and material, you should always look at someone that has less than you. When it comes to the spiritual, you should always look at someone that has more than you. So you can aspire, right? You can grow.
Look on the bright side.
Sorry?
Look on the bright side.
Yeah, but more in this, yeah. So that's the first thing. In other words, where we look at traits which are normally animalistic, which are normally coming from the animal soul, and we see, so how do we use them? How do we channel them? Right? How do we use that for the good? Okay. How do we use the godly soul to channel that trait to something more positive, right? And then there's another very important concept of why the animal soul is not intrinsically bad, and why this concept of serving God with both souls is so important. the Kabbalah says like this, that although godly soul, animal soul, both have all 10 powers. They both have intellect and they both have emotion. They both have the chesed and the gevurah and the tiferes and so on and so forth. But there's a huge difference. The godly soul, the primary force in the godly soul is intellect. Because the godly soul is always interested about, the godly soul's mission is understanding God. Connecting to God through the means of intellect. Right? The animal soul, although it has intellect, the primary force in the animal soul is emotion, like an animal. Right? So I'll give you an example where you see it in people, right? A five-year-old child, what's the primary force in a five-year-old child? Intellect or emotion? Emotion, obviously. Right? In fact, children don't have a very developed intellect altogether. They have tons of emotion, extreme emotion only, but not very developed intellect, right? And normally it needs to be controlled. Normally it's a problem. No, no, not a problem, but it can be a problem, right? Their emotions are very extreme. Children particularly have very little tiferet. They don't have synthesis. It's either very bad or very good. And they switch. They switch one to the other. They very happy or very sad, right? Very pleased or very angry. One of the two, right? And it's unlimited and it's full, right? The hope is when people get growled and they mature a bit and they start to control and guide and temper their and tamer. Right? But the truth is that sometimes what happens, right, to people, mature people, that they actually lose the child. There's something beautiful about childlike passion, right? Which we're actually supposed to hang on to. There's certain creativity, certain risk-taking, certain positivity, certain creativity. There's a certain exploration, a certain love, a certain excitement that exists in children that often doesn't exist in adults, right? And a real healthy pathway in life is to mature, to let the brain take over, but only to guide, not to eliminate the childlike excitement and passion, right? So it's a similar, I'm just giving you that analogy, because it's a similar concept what the Baal Shem Tov and others, the other mystics tell us about the animal soul. The animal soul is driven by impulse, driven by passion, right? Person's greedy, they're greedy, they're going to just pursue things, right? They're angry, they're really angry, they're aggressive, they're really aggressive. If it's uncontrolled, right? It takes a lot of intellect to control emotion. Animal soul by nature doesn't have that. It's very impulsive, like an animal. And negative traits are very, very impulsive. But the truth is that we need to serve God. We need to grow, not just by eliminating the negative emotional responses, but by channeling them, turning them to good, and by retaining some of that passion that exists in the animal soul that doesn't exist in the godly soul. So to use the words of Kabbalah, when they talk about love of God, for example, they say love of God that comes from the animal soul is stronger. If you can get the animal soul to love God, it's stronger than the love of God that comes from the godly soul. Because when you harness the passion, you harness the excitement, the emotional impulse that the animal soul has, it's much stronger. There's a verse, a pasuk, that's used always to explain this concept, and it says, "V'rav tvuot b'koach shor." There's tremendous harvest, the tremendous produce in the power of an ox. Ox being a reference to the animal soul, right? You know, there's amazing, you can get amazing results if you can harness that energy. So it goes back to the point we made last week that every part of the person is created with Tzelem Elokim in the image of God. It's the animal soul, the godly soul, and the body. It's just a matter of harnessing, and it's a matter of channeling it so that we find the good and we're able to find able to harness the power of the animal soul under the guidance and mastery of the godly soul. And when they work together, the result is an amazing result. Which means, which that goes to the point that a person is born with a personality, right? So the first part of growth is to remember, as I said last week briefly, that part of growth is not to let, even though it's going beyond that personality, but it's not to let go of who we are. Because the way God created us with all our flaws is amazing. There's tremendous power there. Right? So when we talk about people changing, and it does also mean embracing things that we're not comfortable with, but it also means nurturing who we are. Because the way God created us, even the flaws He created us with, even the weaknesses He created us with, have tremendous power. It's all B'Tselem Elokim. It's about harnessing that energy, harnessing that power, right? Now, sometimes temporarily, okay, we've got to just get rid of the negative stuff and sort of create a clean slate. Like, I mean, you see it with children. Sometimes you find a child that's got a very strong weakness. I don't know, they keep on bashing up the younger sister. I don't know, whatever the problem is, right? So, or they just, you know, they've always got to be right, or they're just very aggressive. Whatever, our children have things, right? The truth is that all of that has good in it. We just have to channel it, right? Which parents often don't do. Sometimes they just trample the bad or suppress the bad, right? But the truth is that temporarily, of course, you have to suppress it. I mean, otherwise other people get hurt, right? So the first thing is you got to stop. Now let's start discovering how we can channel it, right? Why do I say that? Because there's a mystical formula that's got to do, again, with the time of year we're in, which I'm just going to share with you because it's so relevant to the topic. Because it's a formula which goes to the heart of the whole process. You know, it's interesting, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but that when it comes to Pesach, which represents the beginning of the journey, right? We know that we have to eat matzah, right? And not only have to eat matzah, but chametz, something, wheat that rises, is considered a very bad thing on Pesach, right? It's a very, very big no-no in the Torah, and it's considered one of the most strictest prohibitions. And the only thing you get is matzah, right? And the first time of Pesach, it's a mitzvah to eat matzah, and so on. And we say, why is that? Because chametz represents the ego. Chametz represents rising, and when you mix yourself into the equation, then it's just your egocentric. You got to surrender, clear, clean slate, and then you can start working on yourself, right? Strangely enough, after 7 weeks of working with ourselves, right, representing the seven emotions, we have the festival next week of Shavuot. And in Shavuot, in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash, there was a sacrifice. It was called Shtei HaLechem, the two breads. And those two breads not only didn't have to be matzah, it had to be chametz. There were plenty of flour offerings in the Beit HaMikdash. Most of them actually were not chametz. Right? This particular sacrifice, this was a sacrificial bread, two breads, had to be chametz. So the obvious question is, how does that happen? 7 weeks later, 7 weeks earlier, chametz is a terrible sin. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, 7 weeks later, chametz is a big mitzvah. How did that happen, right? And the answer is very simple. Matzah is only the first step, but it's not the end goal. What is matzah? Matzah is the person who's at the beginning of their journey of personal growth, where they're aware that they have a strong ego. They're aware that a lot of their emotional personality responses are driven by ego, and therefore channeled in the wrong way. Either it's indulgence or hedonism or material pursuit or pursuit of pleasure or aggression or jealousy or resentment, whatever the case might be, right? And therefore the person really wants to sort of grow. Step one to growth is complete surrender. Take away yourself from the whole picture, because as long as you have a trace of your ego there, it's the channeling becomes impossible, because the channeling and the growth all has to do with selflessness, all has to do with giving up our ego, when we're not focused on ourselves, when we're not focused on self, right? So therefore, the step one, as the Maharal of Prague explains, that you have to create a complete clean slate, complete purity, and therefore step one of the process is complete surrender. But that, which is matzah on Pesach. But that complete surrender, in order to make way for the soul, for the nefesh alakit, for the godly soul, for the selflessness, for the spark of the person to actually take effect, right? That is only step one. Because the goal is not matzah. The goal is you have to grow with who you are, not without who you are. Does that make sense? You have to grow with everything that God created you with, including the flaws, including the weaknesses. Now, to start off with, you've got a pause button, right? So therefore matzah, surrender, complete surrender. So that we highlight the behind the scenes forces that are making success or failure. So therefore we have to surrender the ego, which means almost surrendering ourselves, self-negation, which is an important concept in Jewish thought, understood correctly. The base of self-negation is, the foundation has to be, let's take myself out of the equation. It's not about me. It's not about selfishness. It's not about what I want. It's about what's needed. It's about what's moral. It's about what's right. But then, If that's my new path, that's my pursuit to grow as a human being, to live a life of meaning and purpose, to live a life of higher calling, I need to do that with who I am, with what God created me with my personality, not with someone else's personality, with my personality. In order to do that, I have to reintroduce self, which is the Omer. In Omer, we reintroduce self, we reflect on my chesed, on my gvura, on my tiferet, and what is it, and what are my weaknesses, and what are my flaws, and even the flaws, now that I'm focused less on ego, less on myself, I can reintroduce myself. Until we get to Shavuot, which symbolizes the perfection of that process, where chametz becomes a mitzvah. Because self now is no longer egocentric. At the beginning of the process, self is about the ego. At the end of the process, self is about using whatever God created me with, and it's discovering it's good and it's positive. Does that make sense? Yeah? All good? Okay. So, what does this all look like? So that's part one of self-love. But then part two is what we said last week, and so I want to go into it a little bit more. Right? So, again, just to summarize. Part one is God created us with a personality, and that personality needs to be nurtured, needs to be channeled, needs to be steered in the right path, needs to be controlled, needs to be guided. But it's my personality, which is really important because in order to live a life of morality, in order to live a life of meaning, it's not one thing. There are so many different things that are needed in the world, right? And everyone has their area of focus, an area of strength, an area of skill, an area of expertise, right? Some people are more sort of inward-based. Some people are more about, I don't know, individual focus. Some people are more about great change. Everyone's got a different area of strength. And that's okay. That's where it should be. We find that in Judaism also. For example, we find that giving tzedakah, charity, helping people is an incredible mitzvah, right? Learning Torah is also an incredible mitzvah. But so you have those people whose main area of focus is scholarship and learning, and that's what they do all their lives. That's what their main focus of tombs, where they channel their energy. That's their personality. Some people, their personality is able to implement great change in terms of helping people and coming up with amazing innovations to help those that are needy and so on and so forth. That's fine, because that's why God created everyone different. The Talmud says, just like no two people look alike, no two people think alike, because everyone has different contribution to make. We're going to read the Ten Commandments on Shavuot, where God says, I am Hashem, your God, right? And he says in the singular, because he talked to every single individual, saying every individual has a unique mission, has a unique contribution to make, which is so important. And that's why everyone has to work on their area of focus, their area of emphasis, their personality, their strengths, their weaknesses, channeling them and guiding them into a positive space. But it's who they are. Ultimately, you have to reintroduce self, because we're all unique and we all have a unique contribution. However, having said that, equally important, and an equal outcome of selflessness and surrender and getting rid of ego, is the second part of personal growth that we spoke about last week. And that is becoming who we are not. So it actually is two things. It's becoming who we are and also learning to become who we are not. Who we are consciously not, at least, right? And to put that in simple terms, going back to chesed and gevura, that if our area of focus is chesed, it should be nurtured, but we also have to be able to have gevura. And if our area is gevura, we also have to have chesed. So let me just give you a couple of ideas where we find this principle so beautifully brought out. When the Jews left Egypt, God took them through the sea, right? He split the sea. And the splitting of the sea, which we celebrate on the seventh day of Pesach, is considered the culmination of the Exodus, right? It says in the Chumash, in the Torah, when God split the sea, he didn't just put the water away so that you're able to go through on dry land. There was a whole spiritual significance to the whole process. What happened was, it says, V'hamayim lehem chama, the water became like walls on either side. Miminam u'mismalam, right and left. There were two walls on either side, and they went in the middle. The Kabbalists explain, what was the purpose of that? Because as they were becoming free, which means spiritually free, they were learning to grow, they were learning to make, to choose not to be trapped in themselves. God said, the way you do that is you have to always be able to have chesed and gevura. Right and left. You have to. If you're a chesed person, you have to be able to do both, and vice versa. Right? We find this also in the laws of kashrut, or at least kosher animals. Now, although we accept that actually kashrut actually belongs to the category of mitzvah, they don't have a reason. Now we know there's different types of mitzvahs, so those do have a reason, those don't have a reason. Nevertheless, even though kashrut doesn't have a particular reason, but it has tremendous depth and symbolism, right? So we are told that there's, how do you define a kosher animal? What's a kosher animal? A kosher animal has two signs. The sign of a kosher animal is it chews its cud and has split hooves, right?
Yeah.
Split hooves means actually completely split, right? So it's two parts. So again, the Kabbalists explain like this, that the animal refers to the nefesh abamish, the animal soul. Growth, right? The godly soul doesn't have to grow that much. It's the animal soul that needs changing and channeling and guiding and growing and so on. The animal soul needs to become kosher. How do you become kosher? Two ways, two signs. You've got to chew the cud. What does that mean? That's a symbolism of reflection. You always have to revisit things, think about things, break things down to small components to understand if they fit into your values, they don't fit into your values, they're moral or immoral. That's the idea, not just jump into things, but actually revisit them. It's a symbol of reflection and continuous reflection, right? And what's split hooves? Split hooves means that you've got both sides. You're able to do either chesed and gevurah. That's the Kabbalah behind the kosher animals, right? So I'll tell you one final, another idea before we sort of translate what this actually looks like. Did I do this last week? The midnight thing? No, I didn't.
No?
Didn't talk about midnight last week, did I?
No.
Sorry, I sometimes forget where I say what. So there's a fascinating Kabbalistic idea that goes like this. And it sort of encapsulates what this idea of true freedom and true growth is all about. So when God took the Jewish people out of Egypt, there was a moment of freedom. There was a defining moment when they became free. And then according to the Zohar, there was the same moment that the final blow happened to the Egyptians. So the final blow we know was the 10th plague, the plague of the firstborns. And that was also the moment where there was a tremendous divine revelation. And that was the moment that the gift of freedom was given to the Jewish people. When Moses came to Pharaoh, and he told him that moment is going to happen. First when God told Moses that moment is going to happen, God said it's going to take place at midnight. Right? When Moses came to Pharaoh, he repeated it. He said it a bit differently, but he said it's going to happen around midnight. So we see this tremendous emphasis about this defining moment of freedom taking place at midnight. Right? What's the idea? Why midnight? Let me make the question more complex. Not only why midnight, but actually midnight doesn't actually exist. Did you know that?
Yes.
Correct. Time is a moving thing, right? It doesn't matter how many, it's a borrowed term, midnight. It's just when the clock strikes 12, right? But the truth is that it's any millionth of a second either belongs to the first half of the night or belongs to the second half of the night. No such thing in the middle of the night. Right? Make sense? Yeah? Another, like space, same thing, right? No such thing in the middle of this page, you know that? Any particle, minuscule particle on this page either belongs to the first half, or the first half ends, the second half begins. There's no middle. Isn't the space called middle? Right? Which makes it even more difficult to understand. How can the Torah say that it's happening at midnight? Midnight doesn't exist in this world. No such thing. No such thing as the middle.
So why was that term used?
So Kabbalistically the term is like this. So Kabbalah says, again, going back to the two primary emotions of a human being, that the first half of the night is chesed, and the second half of the night is gevurah. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's no midnight. You know why? Because in this world, in creation, everything has a definition. As we started off saying last week, if we want to talk about the 10 powers of creation, fire has to do with gevurah, water has to do with chesed. Different, right? In other words, everything has its parameters, its definition. That's what the definition. That's what the definition of creation is. The definition of a creation is that it's defined. It is something and it's not something else. The definition of the creator, God in other words, is that he's undefined, he's transcendent. He rises above definition. That's true infinity. God is not bound, not by chesed, not by gvura, not by both, not by neither. Right? The only thing that has a taste of that infinity in this world is the human being, as we said last week. Because the human being has the soul which has all 10 powers. It's the human being that, although the human being is part of creation, therefore has a personality by design, but is not bound by that personality, unlike every other creation. Water can't become fire, fire can't become water, but the chesed person can become a guru person when needed, and the guru person can become a chesed person. And that's the symbolism of midnight. God said, when midnight comes, I'm going to give you the gift of freedom. Why? But midnight doesn't exist in this world. That's exactly the point. It doesn't exist in this world, but it exists in the transcendent world. Midnight means the middle of the night, meaning it's the part which isn't chesed or gevurah. In this world, no such thing. But in God's world, there is. Chatzot, midnight, is God's world. And that's the gift he gave us. That we can be either. Right? Now, why is that so important? In other words, again, part of growth is just nurturing who we are, our personality. And then we say that part of growth, or a critical part of growth, is becoming who we're not. So first of all, when we do something that is difficult for us, or particularly if it's something which is completely opposite of our personality, right? That's true surrender, that's true selflessness. In other words, that means it's not about me. It's about what's right. So I'll give you an example. And that runs through everything in this world. Because if we remain locked in who we are, even if it's in our area of comfort, even if we're doing the right thing. So for example, let's say a person is a chesed person. And part of their growth is they nurture that chesed, right? They nurture it and they grow in it and they do more than they used to. And they just keep being kind. And they're just loving beautiful people. They're going to make a terrible parent. Why? Because a parent with only love, a parent with only chesed, has a messed up child. A parent with only gevurah also has a messed up child. Right? So it's a fact. I always say parenting, this is, by the way, I'm using parenting example because in parenting this is a tremendous emphasis. Right?
So then you're saying it's hard when the person has the synthesis, which you said is rare. Is it hard?
It's rare. It's rare to be natural like that. Naturally like that. That's what we have to work on.
Parent doesn't see.
Right. So I always say that. That's why I always tell people that parenting is the greatest opportunity for personal growth.
Well, ideally, you want to have one parent Tiferet and one parent Gevurah.
I mean, one parent Chesed, one Gevurah.
Sorry, Chesed and.
No, that's Gevurah. No. People always think that, but that's actually a mistake. That's just mixed messages. You could have one leaning more Chesed, one leaning more. That's okay. No, but everyone knows. The truth is every relationship is that, right? So part of what we say, you have to be able to embrace that which you don't have naturally. That can mean many things. First, it can mean having them together. And then for example of that is parenting, right? A parent. Now, and that's why it's such an important thing. It's such a good model for general spiritual growth as well. Because if it's about who I am, then I'm going to just do what I am. So I'm never going to think what is necessary here. Right, so if I'm a guru person, I'm just going to end up screaming and shouting and disciplining, where it's good, where it's not good, where it's destructive, where it's destructive. It doesn't make a difference. And loving is the same way. If I'm a loving person, I just love to give, and I just love, and I'm such rachmanis, and I just, you know, so I'm just going to keep giving, even where it's terrible to give. Sometimes it's terrible to give, so I need to know when. Sometimes you need to have a bit of both together. Sometimes you have to be able to, you know. If you have older kids, you'll know. Sometimes a kid will do something, you want to just strangle them, right? Now, you need to strangle them, but just nicely. But chesed, right? So it's good, I don't mean strangled. Literally, I'm saying, sometimes you have to be very harsh with a child, but it's also got to be done with chesed. So it depends. If I'm coming from the point of selfishness, from my ego, I'm just going to scream and shout. If I'm doing what's effective, I'm going to be able to discipline and do it with tremendous compassion and respect and love. Combination of both. It's not easy. That's exactly what human personal growth is about.
I can actually add to that. It's actually very hard.
It's very hard, yes.
Very difficult.
It's very, very, exactly. That's why we've got to keep thinking about it and keep doing it, right? Yeah. But every truth is not just parenting. Every relationship is that way.
Everything is possible. That's why we're here.
That's exactly right. So that's why it's not about my personality. I've got to know what that... That's why King Solomon says you've got to educate each child according to their way, right? So that's... I'm just giving parenting as an example. The truth is every relationship that way. Every relationship works that way. Every relationship works that you've got to have love and respect. Now, now's the time to go into that. But love and respect is chesed and gevurah. Love is connecting. Respect is giving space. Respect the other person's individuality. It's a gevurah thing. You have to have both. Otherwise, it doesn't work, right?
So and if you have it in you as a parent, sorry... Then
you, no one is natural. Almost no one is a natural parent, by the way. Oh, if you can do it as a parent, then you can probably do it in everything else.
Why can't you do it to a spouse or to a friend or to...
Well, no. If you can do it properly with a parent, then you can probably... No, no. So someone who can do it as a parent can easily do it with other people. It does work that way.
Does it come naturally or is it teaching?
No, nothing comes naturally. Because every situation is different.
You can set boundaries with your kids, but then should you be able to set boundaries?
No, because it's a different kind. It's a completely different kind of boundaries. One's a horizontal relationship, one's a vertical relationship. They're very different. So the application is different. The malchut is different, put it that way. Right? Each difference is a lot of work.
It's not just your own children. You might be a teacher.
Yeah, I was giving parenting as an example, of course. Yeah. Every relationship, teacher, everything, all works like that, right? And the truth is, it works like that in everything. For example, let's take religion, for example. Let's take serving God, for example, right? I'll give you an example how chesed and gevurah how they come together. You know, every mitzvah needs chesed and gevurah. And I found this, I have a lot of discussion with people on this. I'll give you an example. So, God gave us mitzvot, right? Let's take an example. Let's take shaking a lulav on Sukkot, okay? Just as an example. I don't know, making kiddush Friday night for that matter, right? Now, we know that every mitzvah has halachot, has laws, right? We know that. Because why? Because every mitzvah is not just a symbolic cultural symbol. A mitzvah is a... Every mitzvah creates an energy, and God gives us the system of how the energy is created. Okay. So, for example, there are lots of mitzvah, there are lots of halachot. How a kosher lulav looks like. If a lulav is split on top, then it's not kosher, it's got to be nice, and the etrog has to be without blemishes. Whole section in the Jewish law, right? Okay. Then there's the mystical understanding, like the love, the excitement of the mitzvah, right? What does the lulav represent? What is the kavanah, the intention, the secret side, the mystical side, and so on and so forth, right? Both important. So you have some people who get very caught up in the minutiae of the law. So they go out and buy an etrog, they check it, they examine it, it's got to be 100%. Kiddush Friday night, same thing, right? The cup has to be a certain size, the certain wine, got to make the blessings a certain way. They get very hung up on these things, very good. And then when it comes to the mitzvah, they just do it very mechanically, 100% flying colors on the laws, very...
No emotion.
Very emotionless, right. Then you get some people the opposite. They're very mystical people. They just love learning the secrets of the mitzvah. They come to lulav and they shake it and they get so excited and they think about it and they reflect and they meditate and all the wonderful things. But they forgot to pay attention. Is the lulav actually kosher or not, right? It's exactly the chesed gevura combination. Laws are very gevura. It's got to be exactly this. It's like about parameters. The mystical side's like infinite. So it's like the chesed part, right? Now, some people are much more prone to one, some are prone to the other. It's okay to have an emphasis on one more than the other. That's okay. But you need both. God says, I need both. I need the body and the soul. I need you to keep the laws. And I need you to have the emotion. I need you to have the meaning behind it, right? So that's just examples of how they come together. You need both together. But then there's sometimes they have one or the other. So for example, let's say a person's a very tolerant person. Tolerance is a chesed sort of emotion, right? Some people are very, very intolerant. The fact is that tolerance all the time is a very bad thing. Why do I say that? Because sometimes you have to be intolerant. We have to not be able to tolerate evil. And sometimes we have to stand up in the world and talk against evil, right? Same thing, right? So sometimes the tolerant person needs to know how to be intolerant.
Well, evil is a very big extreme. You would need to be tolerant throughout life for a lot less than evil.
I understand that. I'm just giving an extreme example because we got the point. But right? But I'm just saying, there's a place for every there's a place for chesed, place for gevurah. So therefore, yes, it's true that a very important part of growth is about nurturing who we are, but equally important, if we really want to grow and if we really want to truly taste the concept of growth and the concept of the infinity that God gifted us with, We have to learn to become that which we are not also. Not all the time. We can keep our area of emphasis, but we have to be ready for that. So I'll give you a biblical example of this, which stares you in the face, right? We know that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Kabbalistically, our patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, represent the first three emotions, Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferet. Yeah? In fact, Avraham represents extreme Chesed, Yitzchak, extreme Gvura in a way. That's why Avraham had Yishmael, who went off the path, and Yitzchak had Esau, and Yaakov, all his children were righteous because he was Tiferet, he brought them together. Okay. But let's take a story with Avraham, right? Avraham is this symbol of unbelievable kindness, to the point that he's 99 and he has undergoes surgery. He's got circumcision, and God decides not to bother him with guests, and he's very upset. That's what the story in the Chumash, right? He's standing outside in the heat of the day. He's recuperating. He's a 99-year-old person, and he's just waiting for guests. Normally they would go, come and go, and he'd go and grab them to come in and be hospitable to them. It's a very, very hot day. God makes it hot, so there's no one outside. No one's coming, and he's in pain. So what does God do? God sends three angels dressed as human beings. Avraham is so excited. He runs to them. Please, you've got to come in. You've got to eat. You've got to this. You've got to that. Finally, he can do a chesed because he lives for kindness. He personifies kindness, right? That's Avraham. What does he tell him? But Avraham's chesed wasn't just chesed. It was godly chesed. It was selfless chesed. Wasn't ego-driven chesed, right? It wasn't about him. It was about, because chesed is moral. It's his area of emphasis, his disposition. It's his, what he's, right? He tells them, please come in. And before you come in, v'rachatzu ragleichem, wash your feet. Why should they wash their feet? Well, he's so kind, but he's worried about his rag. What's the issue? Right? So Rashi tells us, what happened was, he didn't know they were angels. He thought they were natives, the natives of the land, who were pagan worshippers. And one of the forms of pagan worship, as we know, Abraham was against pagan worship. He introduced the world monotheism, right? I mean, he reintroduced the world monotheism, I should say, right? And one of the forms of pagan worship in those days was people bowing down to the dust of their feet. So you have Abraham, Mr. Kind, right? Who says, but just one thing, in my house you don't come in with the dust in your feet. You've got to wash it off before you come in. Right? Why? Because Avraham had true kindness. You see, true selfless kindness. And it was not about him. If it's not about him, it's about that it's right and it's moral. It's just his area of emphasis. That's fine. What's the test that it's not about you? Is that you can, you chesed, and you should be chesed, and you should grow your chesed, and nurture your chesed. What's the sign that's not about you, but it's not about your own ego? That when you need gevurah, you can do gevurah. When Avraham Avinu needs to say, but you know, you can't come in if you don't wash your feet, he can do that.
That's gevurah.
Huh? That's gevurah. Yeah, that's gevurah. And he can do that. And vice versa. So that's the test of growth. The test of growth is therefore, it's about these two things. It's about nurturing who we are, and then it's about sometimes finding areas where we're not comfortable with, and testing ourselves that we can do that also. Not only going beyond our comfort zone in the area that we are disposed to, but it's going beyond our comfort zone in the area that we not disposed to. Going beyond our personality. Embracing that which we are not. And that's the true revelation of the infinity of the soul which God gave us. So we're a bit late, so we're going to stop there. And hope that made a little bit of sense.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hang on, aren't we meditating tonight?
I thought we wouldn't because we're a bit late, so I'm going to